Still got a little vision in this eye left. We're continuing this section, which I am not particularly excited about. This is a little anthropology here in history, but I think it's important for the reasons I've given. We're talking about family patterns, and one of the things we're seeing, just to get our minds working together here, is that what the liberals sneeringly call traditional values, monogamy, one man, one woman, making a marriage, has been the universal human arrangement, regardless of whether people were working under divine revelation or not. That is, whether they had scripture or not. And that is the almost universal arrangement is monogamy. Polyandry is very rare, and even in societies where it's permitted, to review you, it was never practiced consistently, nor was it parallel to monogamy, to normal marriage. Polygamy, both terms are correct as we know, is a little more common. Polygamy seldom involved more than three wives. Where polygamy has been practiced, seldom involves more than three wives. Any man who's ever given his wife a credit card would understand why. Not true. The marriages, I just put the syllabus to clear up a loose end, tie up a loose end. The polygamy that Solomon practiced, and that ancient kings and some Oriental kings of more modern times have practiced, was not genuine polygamy. Those were court marriages. You understand that? Political marriages. Marriages where kings would often have large number of wives. Solomon's wives, he was a polygamist. Many of those wives he probably never saw very often, or at all. Those were the ways of making political alliances through marriage. So they were not polygamy in the normal sense, not all of them. Polygamy, where it is common, is usually an expediency for taking care of unattached females or perpetuating family names and property rights. Deuteronomy 25:5 is a reference to what is called levirate marriage. What is levirate marriage?
Taking your brother's family.
Yes, that if your brother dies, then you take his wife. Why?
If they don't have any children, they keep the family name.
If they don't have any children, to keep the family name going, because the property would stay in the family. In some African tribes, polygamy is a very expedient way of taking care of unattached females where there is no social welfare system or other structures. They cannot work. There's no welfare system to take care of them. Well, they do. They starve. This has been one of the problems, by the way, that missionaries face. Missionaries who have gone into tribal cultures and preached biblical standards have had a real problem where polygamy has been a long-term arrangement, because it's one thing to say to the new Christians, well, you've got the men, you've got to get rid of all your wives but one, always your first one. And some have done that. Well, often it's not that simple, though, because these women have no, what were they going to do? What would they live? You put them out in the street. And missionaries have taken different approaches, sometimes trying to gradually get rid of polygamy, and it's very complicated. I'm not going to get into that here. It's simply to say that polygamy was not simply based on lust or desire for a man to have a lot of wives. Often it was a convenient social expediency. Even in societies where polygamy is practiced, few men have more than one wife because of economic limitations. That is, in tribal societies, polygamy was not often practiced because a man couldn't afford it. He had to buy his wife several cows from her father and had to support her. Women, fellows, wives are expensive. So are husbands. It's interesting that, of course, the modern, the place we find polygamy in America is a we look at premarital arrangements. Here's the principle. In societies where males and females enjoy equal or quasi-equal status, individual freedom of choice is permitted. A partial determinant existing in pressure from members of the family or community and cultural standards. What we're saying is this. In a society like ours, where there is general equality, couples marry whom they choose to marry. Now, this is not an unqualified freedom, not in every case. That is, there is pressure from family, sometimes the larger family, but there is general, and there's the pressure of cultural standards. For instance, there has existed in America a racial exogamy that is very often enforced without much being said about it. That is, there are all kinds of, I dare say that maybe many of you, and true of all of us, that before we would bring, say, marry somebody of another race, we would make sure our family wanted to go along with it. You know, there's no legal thing there, but there is this pressure. So the freedom itself, what I'm saying is, even in a culture like ours, the freedom is seldom absolute. Nor should it be, really. We'll get to that later. We'll talk about it here. In agricultural or pastoral societies, parents often decide. This is partly because land or livestock is often involved in the arrangement. An example of this is the medieval inheritance customs. Another example is the bride price paid in cattle in East Africa, reflecting the fact that the daughter has value in terms of goods and services rendered to the father. And the story of Jacob, Rachel, and Leah is an example of this. You got that? Leah, remember Jacob worked for, when he wanted Rachel and he got Leah and had to work another 7 years to get Rachel? That cultural tradition was based on the fact that those daughters represented value to the father for which he had to be paid. It's interesting how that has been reversed in modern Western, more technological societies. That is, I grew up at the end of an age when large families were an economic benefit on the farm. When a high percentage of people farmed for a living, especially back where I came from, large families were a benefit because the children could work. And children supported themselves and made money, really, for the family. In fact, I had three I can think right now, friends who were, we used to call them welfare children. They were adopted, they were taken into foster homes simply so that they could work. Mm-hmm. I had a friend named Wilbur Kane. I forget Wilbur. We called him Fuzzy. Wasn't too bright. But he was an orphan. And the family near us took him in as a foster, gave him a home. And they loved him. You know, they provided a home. But the other side of that was that they put him on a tractor. They bought an extra tractor, put him on it, and they farmed a lot of land. And he was another hand. That was common. I now think of another one. In my immediate neighborhood, there were four families that had taken boys in. And a part of the deal was that those boys worked on the farm.
Now, nobody thought that was bad. That may sound kind of cruel and impersonal, but it was better than growing up in an orphanage. And they were genuinely cared for and loved, treated like children. They were not mistreated. And all the rest of us had to do the same thing anyway. All the natural children lived that way. We did not think it was unusual, you know, for adopted or for a foster children to live that way. You understand? Because all the rest of us had to do it too. It seemed normal. So large families in that situation were an economic benefit. Now, even on the farm now, with modern equipment, where one man can do the work that 10 or 15 did before, that is not as important. But when the father gets his living at a factory, then children become, as they are, an economic negative. Children do not pay their own way, nor do we expect them to. What you see, or say these premarital arrangements involve a different kind of culture. Whereas today, when I asked my father-in-law if I could marry Linda, he wasn't my father-in-law yet. I did it right. I called him long distance and I said, "I'd like your daughter's hand. And if you knew my father-in-law, you'd appreciate it." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "You can have my daughter's hand if you take the one that's in my pocket." he was kidding, of course, but that is a consideration. That is, people today, whereas before, I can remember farmers saying, "Oh, I don't know what I'm going to do when my boy gets out of high school, because he wants to be a teacher, or, you know, he wants to go away. He doesn't want to stay on the farm. I'm going to have to sell off some of my property." And I know, I saw situations where farmers would sell off property or rent it out or get rid of farm equipment because they lost money. They made less money. They had nobody to run it. Now, today the common theme is, "Well, honey, as soon as the kids get raised and are gone, then we're going to remodel the house." You get the point? We're going to be better off financially. We'll have more dollars to spend when the kids get their education and get on their own. We'll have more dollars to spend. But you see, in an agricultural culture, it's the opposite. That the loss of children is the loss of income. And premarital arrangements, therefore, reflected that. That's what we're saying. And that's the story of Jacob, Rachel, and Leah. Now, let me say a word about this. Let me introduce this here. We're talking about arranged marriages. That's what we're talking about. And in our society, an arranged marriage seems to be a horrible thing. We would not think of it. But to give you a historical perspective, it's not that bad an idea. I'm not for it. For instance, I did not arrange the marriage of my oldest daughter. She found her own husband and then hoped I would approve of him. But I think she'd have probably married him if I hadn't. I don't know if she would or not. Kind of a moot point, because I don't think she'd have found somebody. She would have liked me, but I wouldn't have approved of it. I hope to think she wouldn't. But anyway, the point is, I didn't go to his mother and draw up a contract and then say to my daughter, "Hey, I found a husband for you, and I'm sure you'll like him, but whether you do or not, I've already made the deal." I didn't do that. But you see, we often assume this. Now, this shows a very narrow, short-sighted view of marriage. We often assume that when you had arranged marriages, that they were not happy marriages, that there was no love in the marriage. And that is simply not true. Let me tell you something. Romantic love, the romantic love, I'm going to teach you this. You ready? This is one of the most important things I can teach you guys this quarter. So get your pen out and write this down. If a marriage is going to work, romance must be sustained. We're going to talk about that later in more detail. I am for romance in marriage and all that goes with romantic love. We all want it to be maintained. And listen, romantic love has nothing to do with age. Young people often think that older people are not sweethearts. Only younger people are capable of being sweethearts, and that isn't true. Often young people know a great deal less about it than people who are in retirement age. Okay? But the romantic love that sustains a marriage, insofar as marriage is sustained by romantic love, and it takes much more, but insofar as romantic love is a sustaining force in a marriage, the romantic love that functions this way is, in most cases, and some cases exclusively, romantic love that is created after the wedding. The romantic love that exists before the wedding is not the same thing as the romantic love that is there sustaining the marriage after the 25th wedding anniversary. It has been replaced by something much like it, but much better, much stronger, more like the real thing. You see, now, and I'm not against romantic love before the wedding. I was very much in love with my wife before I married her. She was with me, I hope. As I said, she was. Why wouldn't she be? Book really enjoyed that, didn't he? Let's see here. But you see, in this arrangement, which most peoples of the world in most places have had for most of the ages, the idea of arranging marriages, because so much more was involved than just the immediate relationship, property was involved, inheritance. It was assumed that you married the right person, and that the older people, your parents and others, your grandparents, the extended family, sometimes the whole community, they knew, since you were young and foolish, they knew better than you did the kind of person you should marry. They would pick out the right kind of person, and you would learn to love them after the wedding. Did I talk about this before, about Fiddler on the Roof? Did I talk about this yet? No. That's the theme of the Fiddler on the Roof. Falling in love after the wedding. Now, I think I've got a section on this. I'm going to see how far I want to get into this. Yes. I come to this on page 26 of the syllabus, so I'll not mention it here, except to say, because I'm not going to go any further with it here, except to say that, to repeat my point, that the romantic love that sustains a long-term marriage is created after the wedding. Right? And we must not assume that arranged marriages were loveless, that a romance had no part in it. Now, sometimes they didn't. But as far as romantic love, that one single thing is concerned, I would guess, from my knowledge of the subject, which is limited, but I would guess that arranged marriages, by and large, on the average, had as much love in them, romantic love, as free-choice marriages. And you see, here's the difference between the romance before the wedding and the romance after the wedding. The romance before the wedding is mixed in with all kinds of intense feelings, which are by their very nature temporary. For instance, we all know the difference between a crush and true love. Do we not? A crush is a very painful thing when you've really got a crush on somebody. It's a delightful kind of agony. But did you ever have this experience? I know you have, especially the girls, but the boys too. Whenever you left church camp, you were crying your eyes out because you had met the guy. You just thought you could not live without him. He was the most wonderful thing in the world. And the next Tuesday, you couldn't remember his last name. Isn't that true? Very true. what I used to do in church camp when I went about 3 years, I was a junior high student. And I'd always see some girl I wanted to go to camp, take the campfire on Friday night, spend the whole week. I was too scared to just go up and talk to her. So I spend the whole week, you know, playing the little kids' games you do, trying to get, you know, we're trying to run into them and all this dumb stuff. And I spend the whole week trying to get to know her. I get to know her on Friday and found out I didn't like her. Did that 3 years in a row. Wasted the whole week on the trail of this, you know, with a crush. You understand? I wasted the whole week with a crush on a girl when I actually got to talk with her. I didn't like her. Well, and we know what the word infatuation means, and passion, unfulfilled sexual desires creates a chemistry that is very intense, creates feelings. So what I'm saying is that premarital romance is tied to a lot of temporary, intense, adolescent, immature things, which are not wrong, they're not silly, but they simply are by their very nature, they pass with time. The romance of a mature marriage is connected to a lot of years of suffering together and worrying together and raising, loving the same, having children together and putting up with each other and helping each other through bad times. You see, it's tied to a lot, to more powerful things. What I'm saying is this, that romantic love in a marriage expresses some very profound things which are going to be there. That's why romantic love, which is created after the wedding, is a different kind of thing than the romance. Not completely different, but a different enough that you can put them in two categories. So now that I say that to encourage you. Now I'm not putting down the romance that couples feel before they get married. I'm simply saying it gets replaced by something better, not something worse. And it kind of levels off a little bit, but it's, while it doesn't flash as hot, it doesn't fly as high, you know, it's not as intense as pre-marital romance, pre-wedding romance. It is more enduring, it is deeper, it is, as I say, more profound. And that's really good to know. It's encouraging. And I feel very sorry for the child who grows up in a home where mom and dad really don't love each other. And some of you may have grown up in such a home where they just put up with each other, they endure each other, they get used to each other, and they kind of applauding mutual tolerance. That provides security, and it's better than nothing. But it doesn't teach you very much. Let me say this to you. I don't mean to be too personal. If you grew up in that kind of home, you're going to have to learn how to be something else. You're going to have to pay attention to it and concentrate on it, because it won't happen naturally. Okay, premarital arrangements. Now, what about wedding ceremonies? All the wedding. First of all, wedding ceremonies are almost universally secular. By that are civil, not religious. Now we're not talking about whether marriage is sacred or not. We're talking about the ceremony. It's one thing to say that marriage is sacred. It's something else for a culture to have a religious wedding ceremony. And the reason that in our tradition, although it's fading in our secularized post-Christian society, but at least in our outfit, we still have church weddings. Or at least the preacher will marry and will do it in the name of God, some kind of religious thing. And I'm for that. I think it's great. It's a good opportunity to do some teaching, set some examples. But you see, the reason we have a religious ceremony is because the Romans did. You knew that. We said this in early Christian centuries. This is an overlap with that. The Romans had a religious wedding ceremony, and so the church, in order to wean the pagans away from their paganism, converted many pagan practices, and there's nothing wrong with that. Not required, But you recall that the wedding, and we'll come back, I think we have this a little later in the syllabus, but such things as the wedding ring, the cake, the veil, flowers, carrying across the threshold, getting married in an auspicious month, these are all Roman, pagan things carried over and Christianized. But the Jews in the Old Testament, in Jesus' day, there was no religious wedding ceremony. When it says in John chapter 2 that Jesus went to the wedding at Cana of Galilee, that was not a religious wedding ceremony. That was a feast and all that went with it. Normally, the closest they came to a ceremony was that the bridegroom would ceremoniously escort his bride from her father's house to his house. That's about it. By the way, that's the background of the parable in Matthew 25, the parable of the wise virgins and the foolish virgins. They're waiting for the bridegroom to get back to his house and bring his bride with him ceremonially. But as far as, you know, standing up and taking vows before God, that was not done. In a few societies, does the wedding call for a supernatural sanction. Now, again, let me say this again. We're talking about the wedding, not the marriage. The wedding. There is no wedding ceremony in the Bible. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God and these witnesses. It's from the old Anglican Episcopalian liturgy. It's not in the Bible. A lot of people think it is. I always laugh. You know, when Hollywood tries to portray conservative Christians, they almost always get it wrong. You know, for one thing, you know, in a little House on the Prairie, you'd think that the only song the church ever sang was Bringing in the Sheaves. And I was a classic one time. They were trying to show a wedding, and they had the guy with the Bible saying, "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God and these witnesses together, you know, to join together this man." And well, I can just see him in rehearsal. They said, "Where is that?" And I'm sure they couldn't find the thing, you know. So they said, "Well, they got another copy in this, you know." And so because they were sure it was in the Bible.
A lot of preachers do that. They'll take their copy of the ceremony, put it in the Bible, and hold it. I've seen that.
You wouldn't do that, would you?
No. Usually, buy here in the bookstore to split that.
Well, it's not. There is no religious wedding ceremony in the Bible. Thank you. You see. Traditional. I've already talked about traditional Roman wedding. Now we come to the age of maids. This is interesting. In more primitive societies, girls or women seem to marry younger than men. Here's the general anthropological principle or rule, not a really rule, it's a principle or observation, that the more primitive, less technological and industrialist society is, the larger the gap between the men and the women. The men will be older than the women. The more you move into westernized, industrialized societies where men and women are roughly equal, the age gap closes. And it's interesting. So you got that? That's the general principle. And a certain onus is attached to the unmarried, especially unmarried females. And this is fading away. I'm kind of glad it is. I don't think it's fair. You notice that bachelor is a neutral term. Spinster or old maid is a pejorative. You say, he's a bachelor. That was sort of neutral. You could say, well, you know, he's a bachelor. And a lot of great men were bachelors all their lives. A lot of preachers. You realize some of the most notable preachers in the Restoration movement have been bachelors. Never married. Or you could say, well, he's a bachelor. You know what those people are like. So, but you can say it either way. It's neutral. But if you said a woman was an old maid, she was just an old maid. I mean, there's only one way to say that. I mean, you could raise your voice with a little lilt on the end. Well, she's an old maid. But it didn't work. She's still an old maid. Or spinster. And that really, so more of an onus attached to the woman than the man. Although the unmarried man still, in our culture, is an object of suspicion. If you don't think that's true, you try to get in the ministry single and see how many churches you can't get into because you're single. They want a married man. And there's some grounds for that, but there is this a prejudice. It's a genuine prejudice against the man who would remain single. And that's unfortunate, because a lot of I say a lot of great preachers have simply chosen to remain single, and they've had a hard time of it because there's this onus attached to it, but more so to the women. And that really is, if that's fading, that is, the single person today has gained leading the single life, and I think there's a lot of bad reasons people are staying single today. We'll talk more about that later, but there's a shift in our cultural thinking, so that being single does not carry the onus that it used to carry for men or women, and I think that's good. And I think it's the single woman. Really, we need a word in our language that sort of corresponds to bachelor. That's not so negative.
Bachelorette.
We don't have one, do we?
Yeah.
Now, it has become acceptable. Listen to me. It has become being single has become acceptable for some reasons which are not good reasons in our culture. Not always for good reasons. The idea that many think it's become acceptable because, well, that's the smartest life. No ties, no responsibilities, no children, hang loose. And that's not good. That's very bad. That's counterproductive. On the other hand, much of what we call the singles phenomena is taking on irrespectability, because hear me, we have an increasing number of people in our society, and some of you are some of them, who are not you have not chosen the single life, but you have not married yet, because for the simple reason that young people are staying single longer today. This is an interesting phenomenon. This is a cultural reversal. Did you know that? In 19th century England, the average woman married about the age 17 or 18, but the average man married about the age of 30. For the simple reason that it was considered that a man had to be established the cultural expectation was that a man would be established before he got married. That is, he would be get his education, whatever he would get his education or learn his trade, and ideally buy a house. And when he had had it, when he had a trade and had a house, then he could get a wife. That was before easy, mortgage, 30-year mortgages, and easy, installment buying. And but his wife would often be 7 or 8 to 10 years younger than he was. Now, today, we're shifting, but then we went down to the 50s and 60s, especially the 50s, when a couple, after the war, after the Second World War, when couples didn't have to wait, and they didn't wait. Why? I'll tell you why. Because, see, the average, it was very common for a lot of my friends, for example, who I graduated with in high school in 1958, they could go down to the General Motors plant and hire on and make as much money as their fathers were making, or very close to it, from day one. They could go down to the bank, and they could buy with a minimum down payment. They could buy a house, start making payments. They could buy a car, and get married, and set up shop on the installment plan. A lot of them paid for their homes that way. You understand? And they could, but that because of the change in our economy, the basis of our economy, that is moving from a industrial to a service and technology economy, it's not so easy to do anymore. Is your chances, the chances of a guy getting out of high school today and with just a high school education and going and getting a job to make what his father makes, very slim. What's he got to do now? He's got to go to college, he's got to learn a trade, and it takes longer. And houses have gone up, it's harder to qualify. And so young people have economics rules in this, they're simply waiting longer to get married. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. The major difference between that and what it was earlier is that the women, that this gap does not exist between the age of the women and the age of the men. That is, even though they may wait longer, the bride and the groom, probably pretty close to the same age today. But what this has done, I said all that so I can say this, it has created the phenomenon of the single person, but who is not a bachelor or a spinster. Understand? Not, they have not chosen that way of life. They simply have not married yet. And we're seeing this. For instance, when I was beginning the ministry, nobody ever heard of a singles ministry. Just didn't hear of it. Now, today, we have, most churches have a singles ministry, and it's good, it's necessary. Now, it's true, it's a little more complicated than that. Some of those who are singles are, you have the lifelong bachelors and bachelorettes. Not very many of those. You have many who just haven't married yet, and you have, unfortunately, divorcees. And that's a lot of the singles ministries deal with people who've been divorced. But even at that, you find more single young people today who have never married than you did 20 years ago. By young, I mean who are not, who are 20, 22, 23, before they get married. Yeah. Seriously, my wife and I were 19 when we got married. We were almost 20. And today, I just shrink back in horror at the idea of one of my children getting married before they're 20. But both of us came from families that didn't have a lot of money. We had been self-supporting for 2 years. We'd been supporting ourselves completely for 2 years. We were on our own and paying for our own education. And so we saw no reason. We rented a little apartment and got married. But it was easier then. It's harder now. Well, early marriages reflect the lifespan in any cultural age, as well as economics, you see. That is, when people did not live as long, they got married earlier. In recognition of puberty, economic conditions, infant mortality rate, and so forth, cultural expectations either lengthen or shrink the time young people take to achieve puberty. Do you realize that? That we talk about physical maturity when puberty goes through the age in which after which you're physically prepared to be parents. What girls are, boys mature. The puberty for a boy is not as marked a thing, of course, as it is for a girl. It's very important physically. But you realize that the age span varies with cultural expectations. That girls today are going through puberty 2 or 3 years earlier on the average than they did 30 or 40 years ago, because of they're expected to. As soon as they get into junior high school, they're expected to be adult-like. They wear adult clothes. They start wearing makeup. They start dating, don't they? And there's the expectation. There was in the 20s, this was an end product of the Romantic movement. In the 20s and 30s and 40s in America and England and much of Western Europe, but I'll speak of America because I know about that. There was this long age in which young people, especially girls, were allowed some years between the time of being little girls and being women. They didn't have to move in a year and a half from being little girls to being women. It was this long, lazy, and they would have years to ride bicycles and read books and write diaries and try their hand at writing stories and take piano lessons, and they would learn how to crochet and sew, and they would have long week-long summers with girlfriends. They weren't under pressure. They didn't have to grow up. As a matter of fact, there arose a whole literature. There was a whole body of literature that girls designed just for girls of that age, and boys too, but the girls more so. And now those books are all gone, and girls move very quickly, as do boys, but girls more markedly. from young womanhood very quickly, actually from childhood to womanhood, shrunk. And they change physically early. Did you know that? Early days. For instance, in societies where a girl is expected to be married by the time she's 13 and start a family, so we would call primitive societies, well, she'll go through puberty at the age of 9, 10. That's unusual. That's unusually young. But it was not. You realize it was not uncommon in your grandparents' day for a girl to be 15 years old and still not through puberty. So I'm just starting then. Why? Because there was not that pressure on them to do that. Did you all realize that? Yeah. The actual. I don't know all the particulars involved in that, but I know it's true. In advanced societies, the age differential between mates shrink. I've already said that. It is generally more acceptable if the husband is older than if the wife is the older one. That's interesting. In most societies, it's okay to have a gap of age as long as the man is the older, which is really absurd. Somebody tell me why it's absurd.
Physically, sexually, the difference between men and women, women advance quicker than men.
Yes, girls mature earlier than boys do. You know, if you don't believe this, you try running a week of junior high camp. My idea of hell used to be a week of junior high camp. It never ended. You just went to junior high camp and you stayed there for eternity.
It's always Monday.
Yeah. It's always Monday, junior high camp. And one of the problems you have at junior high camp is you've got these girls running around who are teenage, you know, who are young ladies, and most of the boys are still dippy little boys. You know, they belong in junior camp and the girls belong in senior camp, and you put them both together in junior high camp. And we always had out in North Florida, we'd have one or two high school boys who would come back junior high camp just so they could make out with the girls. They always had some excuse why they couldn't come the right week. I know what they were doing. Or if you get a boy who advanced, who had matured a little bit earlier, who was a little bit older, while the girls, they would flock to them and ignore the poor little old fellows, you know, who came to their shoulders and had a frog in their pocket. And right. You see, what's the other reason why it's kind of silly to look down upon the older woman and the younger man?
Because women live longer.
Yeah, women live longer than men do. And the lifespan, which I think is grossly unfair, yes.
Wouldn't that be an advantage, though, to have a guy older in terms of maturity-wise, so they're on the same level?
Well, once you go past 17 or 18, it doesn't make a difference. That gap is closed.
My mom and dad, my mom's 3 years older than my dad. They've always, you know, worked out fine, you know, because maturity, you know, once you hit your 20s, they're both the same.
Yeah.
There's no big deal.
The difference between a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old is a huge difference. The difference between a 25-year-old and a 22-year-old is nothing. Very little. That's true. Now, there are some marriages, but this is just a cultural thing, and there's no reason for it. There's no logic to it. But it's true. An older man can marry a younger woman, and he may raise a few eyebrows if the age span is too much. You know, if it's a December, June wedding, people say, well, he's a dirty old man. If it's too big of a difference. And, of course, you know the phenomena of the male menopause, where men go through the midlife crisis and they get to be 45 years old and realize that their wife is getting old and they're getting older, and they will try to grasp, snatch at life, and they'll, you know, unbutton their shirt, buy a gold chain, get a wig, and a new wife. I'm not making that up. It's exactly what they do, and it's a great tragedy.
But it's not looked down upon. It's not looked down upon nearly as much. My opinion, it's not looked down upon. It's not looked down upon enough. But it's not looked down upon like a 45-year-old woman who would marry a 27-year-old man. She would really be looked down on. And it's not fair, but that's true. Any comments on that?
It's also unfair. Well, not unfair, but it's looked down upon when a man marries for 25 or 30 years and he raises his family and turns around and marries a 20-year-old girl.
Yes, I said that, but it's not looked down on as much as if the woman married a man that age. That's it, but that's just a cultural thing. Do you all know of any cases where there's been a 8 or 10 year difference between the man and the wife, and the wife was older? That many, you know, I don't know that I know of any cases.
In my church in Miami, we had an older woman, and I knew her, and I dated her son. And a couple of years later, we went back down to Miami after Georgia, and she's like in her 50s, and she married a Haitian man, a black man on top of that, and she's white. And he's like 20, I think it's like 26, and she was like 52. And on top of that, he was black and she was white, and it really, got everybody going in that church. And
the
older
so.
Church, older people, and they had a heart attack, most of them. So, I mean, that was really the down upon. And then they had a baby.
Yeah,
and
yeah. You're right. See,
she had a baby. He is a gorgeous little kid. But he is.
Well, look, let me point out something. You hear what she said? Now, she's looked down upon, wasn't she?
Yeah.
But suppose, I bet you one of the deacons in that church, who was, how old was she?
She was 52.
52. And she married, I bet if a 52-year-old deacon married a woman who was not even a Christian in her 20s, he would not be looked down on hardly at all by the same people. He could marry outside of the faith and go back. You understand? Go back that many years and marry a woman, and they'd say, "Well, you know, that's the way men are." They would be, and he would find an acceptance that she wouldn't find.
They eventually left the church because it was so bad.
Yeah, see what she said? They eventually left the church because it was so bad. Now the deacon wouldn't have to.
Yeah.
That is, it's grossly unfair to women. By the way, even emotionally, women do mature. It's interesting; they do mature faster than men do. For instance, the average girl in here—I suppose our ages, the male, female—I don't count them up, but the male, female ages in here probably. If you knock out a couple of us older married men, that would kill the averages. We'd probably come out about the same. But the average age, the average female age in this room would be roughly the same as the average male age. Yet, the average girl in here is more mature at this point than the average man. Emotionally mature. Yeah. It's not real. It wouldn't be noticeable, but it would be. Well, we come to marital residence, and I'm not say a word about. Well, our time is up. We just have a couple, 3 minutes left. I think we'll start there next time we meet.